All right, everyone, it's Thursday, October 17th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I don't want to talk about the rain. I do, however, want to talk about the wind. Okay? Let me just say. So I saw that I had left the lights on my front porch. So I decided to walk up to my front porch to turn the lights off. I got to the porch. Lamps broken. 150-pound, like, thing fell over. I've never seen so much damage on my porch. And this stuff has been on my porch now for almost a decade. So whatever the gusts were last night, the power of those gusts was un-freaking believable. It was just – so I have to go back and, like, clean everything up. But, I mean, things that I've never, ever – I mean, it's tucked in. It's away. It's sheltered, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, when the wind is sort of swirling, it was absolutely amazing last night. So, well, we do have, you know, wet. And that also means all the leaves are now on the backyard and I got to rake. But anyway, that's okay. I mean, I love fall. I love fall. I got to rake. I love fall. Anyway, on that note, on this October 17th, we have to actually – first express the tragedy, the remorse, the sadness of losing Representative Elijah Cummings. And as I said to Ken, I said, I wonder if I was channeling or sensing this might happen, because we're going to be talking about Cory Booker today. And Cory Booker, it's an interesting interview from the Christian Science Monitor. So, and you'll understand why, thinking about Elijah and thinking about Cory, I sort of see them in some ways on a similar plane, all right? And then the last thing I did at the end of the discussion of what we're going to talk about today, I always throw something in at the very end. And I listed it under Amen. And what listed under Amen was a article written by one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter. Now, understand, I put this together last night before Elijah had died. And basically what she was saying in her piece was that cops should not be the ones to show up when you have a family member that has a mental breakdown. Mental illness doesn't go to jail. Mental illness doesn't have to have a cop respond. Mental illness needs a mental health worker. And it's a really, really interesting piece. And she's absolutely right. We know that story almost intimately well in New Hampshire because we didn't have a place where we could put people who have severe mental illness. We actually put them into prison because we didn't have a high security hospital. So anyway, that was the things that I posted last night. And then sure enough, look what happens over the course of the evening. We lose a great, great congressman. Anyway, on that note, what's going on in your world?
Well, let me just add to what you said about Elijah Cummings. I remember just a short while ago, however many months ago it was, when he was beginning to hold some of the really probing, aggressive hearings into the Trump administration's continuing litany of horror. And we were talking on this show, and everyone else was talking too, about just what a wonderful guy he was, what a leader, how he, by his presence, was really modeling American values and civility and democracy
and kindness.
Fairness. Yeah, right. And kindness, just the opposite of what the president was modeling. So it really is a huge loss, a huge loss. So what I wanted to talk about today was in a totally different part of the world, actually. And that is Lebanon. There was an interesting piece by David Ignatius in the Washington Post following up on Syria and what's happening with Turkey and the Kurds and Syria. And his headline is, Syria is lost. Let's save Lebanon. It's really interesting because the Turkish invasion and not only murdering Kurds and freeing ISIS and giving Assad, the dictator, back huge power and control over his country – the fact is that it's rippling through the Middle East, and as we all would have predicted, no country can feel that it can rely on the United States to support it when it's in trouble. So people in Lebanon are afraid that they're going to be the next country that's going to be discarded by the United States. Lebanese politicians – I'm reading from Ignatius's article. Lebanese politicians and security officials in a series of off-the-record conversations expressed concern about Trump's acquiescence to Turkey's invasion of Syria and the seeming eclipse of U.S. power. The Lebanese official feels sorry for America.
But not exactly.
He's more afraid for his own country. And several Lebanese officials said the withdrawal of U.S. support for its allies in Syria all but guarantees an eventual victory – in Syria for that alliance, which includes Iran, Russia, and the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad. And a top Lebanese politician says the Iran-Syria-Russia axis has won. Syria will be united again as the regime makes a deal with the weakened Kurdish militia, unable to stop it. For Iran, this Lebanese says, the Syria denouement is ideal for Iran. Who could offer them a situation better than that?
Exactly.
Lebanese anxiety about this is a matter of their own self-interest because Lebanon survives on a balance. They maintain a balance.
Between Christians.
Between everything, between East and West, between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
We did an article about
Sunnis and Shiites, Christians and Muslims.
I mean, it's quite remarkable. It's quite remarkable.
Unlike any other country in the Middle East, it really is. It's a half and half Christian and Muslim government, but the precarious structure has been held alive for decades by the belief that the United States, in the end, wouldn't let the country be dominated entirely by enemies of the West. And now that they can't have faith in U.S. power, they wonder if that's going to lead to their downfall. Hezbollah is really in control of the government.
Right.
They're the power among the so-called equals, and the Hezbollah leaders are absolutely ecstatic. They're gloating about what's happened and how America can't be trusted. They're literally saying, you know, you can't rely on America. You have to come join us.
Donald Trump, he's dangerous. He's so dangerous.
Ignatius may be right that Trump should, God forbid Trump, but our country should focus on keeping Lebanon stable before it too becomes another Syria.
He doesn't care. There is no policy coming out of Donald Trump.
No.
I understand what we should do.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump doesn't understand the word should. That's the problem. What Donald Trump understands is me, myself, and I. He doesn't know the world. He doesn't care about the consequences. He doesn't play things out. That letter that he sent the other day that I read, oh, my God. I mean, I want a second-grade teacher to read that letter to their class and say, would you please correct this? You know, it was just – it's embarrassing. But it's not embarrassing. It's him without a filter.
Yeah. Well, obviously, you know, we Americans can't rely on Trump to do the things that America should be doing in the world. But this is a real heads up that
Congress, whoever
is speaking out to try to raise American consciousness about Trump administration doing something wrong, we should start focusing on Lebanon and make sure that they pay attention to it too.
Exactly, exactly. All right, we're going to be joined by a Christian Science Monitor reporter talking about Cory Booker. She wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, and it's actually quite beautiful. And I wanted you to hear it, and I wanted to talk about it. He's like 1 or 2% in the polls. He was sort of the moral voice on that debate stage the other night. He gave the best speech at the Democratic convention in New Hampshire. So there's clearly an ability. He's a great orator. But whatever it is, he's not been able to connect. And that's kind of curious. And I'm trying to figure out why. Maybe it's because we want someone who will stand up to Donald Trump. Maybe it's because he hasn't figured out what Elizabeth Warren has figured out, which is policies. Maybe he hasn't figured out what Bernie has figured out, which is how to sort of strut the progressive message. And of course, Bernie is lucky because he's never taken money from pharmaceutical companies. He's never worked with Mark Zuckerberg. When you're a mayor of Newark, a very poor challenged city in New Jersey, you'll work with probably anyone in order to help your city. So, you know, sometimes virtue is because you're virtuous, and sometimes virtue is because of your geography. I just want to remind everyone. But once again, I also want to share something else. So a friend of mine sent me something, and she said, I want you to see this, Arnie. In my little town in New Hampshire, we have never seen in the town hall a picture of a United States president. For the first time ever in the last couple of weeks or months, they put up a picture of Donald Trump. All right, you can do that. I mean, he's our president, and you may hate him, you may love him. But a president probably is an appropriate thing to have in a town hall, even though they've never, ever, ever had a picture of a United States president in the town hall. But here's the kicker. So what just happened was that under the picture of Donald Trump in the town hall, where there's never been a picture of a president, the following was put underneath Trump's picture in the town hall. Ready? It says, no Russian collusion, no obstruction of justice, no grounds for impeachment. House Democrats are a disgrace to the United States of America. This is now the added value to the picture of Donald Trump in this town hall. So I think I need to call the ACLU and make sure the Attorney General is aware of this. But this has never happened in the history of the community. This is to show you how polarized we are, which maybe actually is a good reason why we're going to be talking about Cory Booker. Because what I can tell you about Cory Booker is that he is trying to figure out a way to thread the needle and wed us back together, to take this quilt of America as it's being frayed by Donald Trump and say, is there a way for us to find sort of a common voice, a common value? And that really has been the essence of his campaign. The fact that he's 1% or 2% in the polls sort of tells you that it's maybe something we can't hear right now. But it's a message that I love. What can I tell you? So I saw this piece at the Christian Science Monitor, and the title of the piece at the Christian Science Monitor was With Love, Cory Booker, Inside One Long Shot Bid for the White House. And as I was reading this, I suddenly realized, you know what? I need a good news story. And what is so ironic is that we picked this good news story today, the day that another, I think, person who spoke with love has just died, Elijah Cummings. So in some ways, this is kind of a bookend conversation. And joining us right now is Krista Case Bryant. She is the writer for the Christian Science Monitor. You wrote this piece, Krista, at the beginning of October. Maybe in part today, it's even more relevant because we're all sort of expressing this incredible remorse and misery and broken heart with the loss of Elijah. But I see a lot of what Cory talks about and how he tends to sort of come from both his civil rights background and his mayor of Newark, that he really is trying to tell people that, you know, there is this power and strength in love and not in hate. So let me welcome you to the program.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
So why don't you start by telling how you begin your story? Because we all invite candidates to our houses in New Hampshire, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we're supporting them. But at least at the very beginning, our houses are always open and available to presidents in waiting. And you begin with a story from Hanover, New Hampshire, where a state representative who I actually know opened her home to Cory. But let's sort of start with that as your beginning.
Sure. So I had the opportunity to talk with State Senator Martha Hennessy, and she was telling me how she's always loved Cory from the beginning, but she didn't think that she would be endorsing him. And she told me about the first time she heard him speak, and she thought, wow, he sounds like a Baptist preacher. He was so love and hope. And she said, I was almost in tears, which is an effect he seems to have on many people. Yeah. I think there's just something about the way he speaks that really moves them. We can get into that a little bit later. But then right on the heels of that thought was, I'm not sure America is ready for this, or they might not like it. It's just maybe a little too touchy-feely for where we are right now. And nevertheless, she and her husband invited him to stay overnight with them, which is something he's doing throughout the state to get to know New Hampshire better, and just had a really, really nice conversation with him. And she said it was like having a friend visit from college. And it's interesting that she said that because a pollster that I talked to who's been following Cory since 2002, he's based at the Monmouth University Polling Institute in New Jersey, said, you know, that's sort of the impact that Cory seems to have wherever he goes. Everybody wants him to be their friend, but they're not ready to date him, you know, it's sort of this political courtship. So that was the sentiment that State Senator Hennessy expressed. And yet, after following Senator Booker and a number of other candidates for some months, she eventually did decide to endorse him. And I thought it was interesting, her explanation of why, because she said her head was really going for specifically a woman candidate because she just felt so traumatized by Clinton's loss in 2016. But she said ultimately it came down to her heart. And she said, I would love to just talk about all the things I can't stand about the current administration, but I'm not finding it very productive. I need hope. I need myself to believe that not only can we get all the great progressive measures, but also that we can learn to think about each other again and care for each other again and somehow put hatred aside. And so that was what ultimately prompted her to endorse him.
So a couple of things. One, I mentioned to you before, and I also mentioned to the audience before you came on, that when he spoke at the Democratic Convention in New Hampshire, he gave by far the best speech. I mean, no one talked about it and wrote about it, but everybody who went there said, wow, that was really good. That was amazing. I mean, am I right?
Actually, I said that
on
this show.
Yeah, you said we both did. We both did. I know, but not a lot of people. How much mileage did he get on it? I mean, let's be honest,
no, that's
Ken.
True.
But we both talked about the fact, wow, that was absolutely, I mean, he punched out way above everybody else and really resonated with the audience. And you could see that he captured the attention of a room that was, frankly, not ready to focus on him. Mm. So understand, when you have so many people speaking at this huge convention, you know, it's hard to get people's attention because they're always distracted and they're waiting for their person, okay? And he literally got everybody like, wow, All right. So that clearly is what he's capable of doing. And then I think I told you this, Krista, is that I went to hear him speak in Claremont, New Hampshire. And that was very early on this summer. And I went to one of the poorest towns in the state intentionally because I wanted to hear him there. It's a very white community. It's a very poor community. It's very challenged economically. And I thought, well, it's kind of the mirror image of Newark. I mean, it's not black, it's white. Is it poor? It's poor. Lacks infrastructure, lacks infrastructure. Lacks investment, lacks investment. I'm kind of curious to see how he'll resonate in this community. And I mentioned to you that the woman that introduced him is what made me want to pay attention to him. And it was this brilliant, articulate woman who had gone to Stanford with him, who was the niece of the beloved agriculture commissioner, Steve Taylor, who everybody adores, longest-serving agricultural commissioner in New Hampshire. Just, again, someone with an incredible moral compass, you know, whatever. And she had gone to school with him and was, I guess, lived on his dorm floor. And he played football, and she didn't give a crap about football. But she actually liked Corey. So they would go to football games to watch and cheer on Corey. And she told the story of that after the games, and there were apparently two female roommates, he would see them and they would see him and they would, you know, come over to hug him. And he would pick one woman up under one arm and one woman up under the other arm and lift them up off the ground. And she said, "We felt so safe. We felt so cared for. We felt so loved." And then she turned to us and said, "And that's what he can do for America." Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I mean, everyone in the room couldn't breathe. And everybody looked at Corey, and Corey looked at her and went, "Wow, thank you." But it's so funny because she's known him since Stanford. And what you were writing about and the man you're describing and the man that we saw on the debate stage and the man that we, you know, heard at the Democratic convention and then at the politics that eggs and how you end is truly an interesting human being. But I guess here's one of the things I hear about him, Kristen. I don't know if you got into this, but you have to ask him the question. He was a mayor in Newark, and Newark is a challenged community. I want to know more about what happened with Zuckerberg and the money he got from Zuckerberg. I want to know more about, you know, his relationship with Big Pharma and the pharmaceutical companies. Because when it comes to education, it's such an important issue. And what the hell did Zuckerberg know about education but that he could cut big checks? And, of course, Big Pharma has become a real problem. We've seen it with the opioid crisis and so many other things that they've controlled health outcomes. Did you get a chance to sort of hear him get pushed on these issues? Did he talk about those issues? And how do we thread that needle at a time that a very progressive message seems to be resonating? And at least what he seemed to do in Newark seemed to undermine some of those progressive solutions.
Yes, I made an intentional decision not to go really into the weeds on his Newark record because I felt that would be a separate story, and I wanted to keep this story focused on something that you touched on earlier, which is, you know, he has such a message of love. He has this way of making people feel safe and cared for and sort of bound together with common ideals. And yet there's concern that in 2020, that's not what's needed. We need a fighter. We need someone to go hard. And so how can you, will that message of love be something that people see as credible and electable? And also, you know, once people hear it and respond the way they did at the New Hampshire State Democratic Convention, why is that level of enthusiasm not transferring into higher polling numbers so far? So that was what I focused on mainly on this, in this story. I did look into the Newark, his Newark record a bit and talked to a few people in New Jersey. So I'll just touch on that briefly, but I don't want to present myself as an expert on those issues.
No, that's fine, Krista.
You know, I think as one person put it, he was kind of a big vision guy, and he was a cheerleader for the city and for trying to revive its image or restore its image or turn it into something new and refurbished, you know, and that was really good. And at the same time, he wasn't sort of a nitty-gritty in the details kind of guy who figured out, you know, okay, now that you have $100 million from Zuckerberg, how are you going to use it? And did you use it in the best way? And, you know, doing a whole postmortem on that. And I think there were a number of other issues where he sort of had a big vision but maybe didn't execute down to every last detail as satisfactorily as people wanted. Yet this person said, you know, before that, nobody cared about anything in Newark. So the fact that he cared about giving it sort of a facelift and a new sense of self-worth was something that was really valuable. As for, you know, whether his values and the way that he governed in Newark are commensurate with progressive values, I mean, He's very progressive in a lot of ways, as I note in my story, and he's for right. Medicare for All. He wants to start a special office in the White House for advancing abortion rights. I mean, when you look at him, and this is something Senator Hennessy said, you know, he pretty much matches up with most of the other progressive candidates in terms of his values, but he has shown a willingness to work with Republicans and you know, maybe compromise on some of those values when he thinks it's for the best interest of the people that he's serving. So he had this relationship with Governor Christie, who's a Republican, and that was part of, you know, Zuckerberg's.
Right.
It basically invested in their partnership, because right. I think when Booker took over Newark, the schools were still under the administration of the state rather than the city, and so that's why the governor was involved. And they, you know, Governor Christie and Mayor Booker really did have a genuine partnership, and they didn't see eye to eye on everything, but Booker was willing to work with him. And yes, some people will say that tarnishes his progressive reputation. Other people will see a pragmatism there that they feel is really lacking in national politics right now.
Well, what's the compromises that he made to Christie in exchange for whatever good progressive things he was able to get out of Christie in this partnership?
Well, I think the educational community was not happy with the decisions that they made with Zuckerberg and Christie. I think that was part of the problem. They felt left out of the conversation, that these sort of wealthy and Republicans came in to reform education. And even though, yes, it was still under receivership or under the state protection, that the suggestions and the solutions turned out not to be successful. Am I correct, Krista?
That sounds about right. But again, I don't want to present myself as an expert on
So let me just say something. And I said this before, and I'm going to say this to you, because I think as you follow other candidates, and I'll use Bernie as my example. So Bernie was the mayor of Burlington. He was the congressman from Vermont, and now the senator from Vermont, and now a presidential candidate. I hate to break it to you, but all the problems of the state of Vermont would not equal two blocks in Newark. Now, let's be honest here.
Sure.
So Bernie has never really faced the kind of challenges that you would see for people who've had to be in Baltimore, or like Elijah Cummings, or in Newark, like a Cory Booker, or in Detroit, like whatever. And you and I both know that fixing the pipelines or the water system is not as sexy as fixing education. Everyone sees education. Nobody sees the corroded pipes. I mean, that's the sad thing. So people will be pissed off until they, you know, till they have lead poisoning. So that's, you know, I can understand. So that's part of the problem is geography. Also, either protects you or hurts you, because some geography is more blighted, and it becomes a greater challenge as to how you make the decisions you make in order to address those challenges. And sometimes those solutions aren't perfect because it's hard to get to those solutions. That makes sense.
Certainly. And I do think that these are issues that will come into further examination if Booker does rise in the polls and becomes a more top-tier candidate. But I think you would look at it another way, too, which is, okay, yes, it's a problem, it's a challenge trying to govern a place like Newark. But for Booker, it was really this amazing proving ground. And
yes,
what was so interesting to me in researching this story is, before I really got into it, I saw Booker as sort of, you know, a let's-all-hug kind of candidate. Mm-hmm. And when he talks about love, and, you know, he mentioned this in the debate the other night, he said love is not anemic. Love is about service. It's about struggle. It's about sacrifice. He said to me on the phone, love is what brought us to the beaches of Normandy. Love is what brought blacks and whites together to
right.
form the Underground Railroad. I mean, love does powerful things. And I think Newark for him has been a testing ground for that. And there were times he said, you know, when it just broke him as a person, and when he felt drawn by the seduction of hate and wanted to lash out. And yet he saw people around him, like he talks about his mentor, Miss Virginia Jones, a lot. And she was a woman who had lost a son to a shooting right in her own apartment building, and had responded to that with such resilience and love and persistence to push on. And she brought that to Corey and showed that to him and showed him how to see something beyond what others saw as a blighted city, you know. And he, I mean, I don't know how many people know this about his background, but he lived in, like, the worst neighborhoods in Newark for,
exactly.
I think, the better part of 20 years. And, I mean, he still, I believe, goes back there when he's not serving in Washington. And that's an experience of, like, living face-to-face with the pain and the struggle of inner-city America that I don't think very many presidential candidates have. And the fact that, I mean, he did so many things that he didn't have to do, and some people might think they're political stunts. Like, he would have career counseling sessions at his apartment at 6 a.m. in the morning for men who are homeless or who had just gotten out of prison to try to help them get back on their feet. Or you know, as he famously, like, rescued a woman from a burning building, or all these different things. And one that really stood out to me about his book was he was out for a walk with his dad, and a man was shot and murdered right there, and he went over as soon as he heard the shooting and tried to help this man, and his hands and arms got all bloody, and ultimately the young man didn't make it. And Corey went back to his apartment and described this very poignant moment of trying to wash that blood off his arms and his hands, which were shaking, and just that feeling of, like, why could I not save him? Either, like, in that moment or in a broader sort of systemic sense, why can't I save people from being murdered in my own city? And, you know, that's just a really
profound
thing to have to deal with. And so when he gets up there and he talks about how we need to love one another, I think it means a lot more than sort of a kumbaya sense of, like, hey, I came up with this nice idea in my living room.
I know. I hear you.
And so in that sense, Newark, I think, adds credibility to what he's saying he wants to do.
Go on, Chris. Well, my greatest resentment is he's never been given the time on a national stage to tell those stories. We don't see those connections. We don't see the power of love. We don't understand that it is actually more powerful than hate. You know, Donald Trump has so changed the landscape that I'm going to, what does Biden say? I'll knock him out, or I'll punch him out, or I'll do whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh God, put that fist away. You know, I mean, that's not what this conversation is about. It has to be about the power of ideas, the power of forgiveness, the power of words. And that's what Corey delivered at the Democratic Convention. It's what he delivered, I think, at Politics and Eggs. And I need to let you go, but I just want to remind everyone, he spoke at this event where there were a lot of, as you point out, a lot of well-coiffed crowd of businessmen and some state legislators. And at this Politics and Eggs in New Hampshire, at the end of his speech, they rise one by one and they give their guest a standing ovation. Something they rarely do. Krista, thank you for writing this piece. And I think we needed this story today. As we mourn the loss of Elijah Cummings, we have to be grateful that we have someone like a Cory Booker. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me on.
All right. You're welcome. All right. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1987. That was the day that more than 100,000 people gathered in Paris to stand up against poverty and hunger. The gathering was inspired by Father Joseph Racinski, a French Catholic priest. He founded the All Together in Dignity Fourth World Movement, dedicated to addressing poverty. That day unveiled a commemorative stone to honor the victims of extreme poverty. The stone bears an image of two people, arms outstretched, releasing a bird into the sky. The stone's inscription read, "On this day, defenders of human and civil rights from every continent gathered here. They paid homage to the victims of hunger, ignorance, and violence. They affirmed their conviction that human misery is not inevitable. They pledged their solidarity with all people who, throughout the world, strive to end extreme poverty." The site they chose to place the stone was significant. The Trocadero Plaza in Paris is where the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed by the United Nations in 1948. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights affirmed the basic rights of all people, including the right to form and to join trade unions, and the right to equal pay for equal work. Placing the commemorative stone at this important spot was a continuation of this legacy. In the years since then, on this very day, other cities around the world have commemorated replicas of the stone. Nearly 20 cities in France have dedicated stones. Cities in Canada, Mexico, Switzerland, Belgium, Ireland, Scotland, Great Britain, Italy, Poland, Portugal, and the Philippines have all placed these tributes. In 1992, the United Nations declared today, October 17th, the annual International Day for the Eradication of Poverty.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On hot summer days, the shade of a big tree can provide relief, not only for people, but cows. So as the climate warms, some farmers are growing trees in their pastures. The practice, called silvopasture, helps protect the animals from heat. And it helps slow global warming because trees store a lot of carbon. Jen Halpin is director of the Dickinson College Farm in Pennsylvania, which serves as a demonstration site for silvopasture. Halpin says red oak, crabapple, and locust trees grow in the farm's pastures. She says the team chose native species that would not only provide shade, but food for the cows.
The locusts shed pods. The pods are a source of protein for the cattle.
But protecting young trees from the livestock has been a challenge. The students and staff put electric netting around the trees, but it collapsed under the weight of heavy snow. They had to replace it with posts and wire. But Halpin is happy the farm can serve as a living laboratory.
I feel like a role that our college farm plays within our larger agricultural community is to be that site where we can trial and error without breaking the bank or the farm going under.
So by sharing lessons learned, she hopes to help other farmers reap the benefits of silvopasture. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
This is done for Donald Trump. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and my producer Ken Barnes picks our music.
Of course.
So who sings Shame, Shame, Shame?
This is for Donald Trump, of course.
God.
It's Johnny Winter, and you'll see in the closing song that it's Spiritual by John Coltrane, and that's for Elijah Cummings.
Thank God we end that way.
Yeah.
I guess we have to acknowledge the politics of the moment, and the person who's the best at acknowledging any kind of politics at any moment is joining us on the line. Bill Curry is a two-term Democratic nominee for governor in the great state of Connecticut. He is a columnist at Salon.com. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He is one of the finest political commentators I know, and people keep saying, I'm so glad I found Bill Curry. I get people from Iowa. I get people from Texas going, I never heard of him before. Wow, how did I miss him? And I'm like, I wish I had a bigger show. I'm so sorry, Bill. Anyway, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
So,
it's always a deeply affirming experience to be with you.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm a good suck up, or at least I tell you the truth. I mean, what can I tell you? So, I saw a tweet this morning, and I want to talk a lot about healthcare because that really was sort of the almost the essence of the debate on this week with the different candidates. And, you know, Elizabeth Warren was sort of trashed because she couldn't say the word taxes. And then Bernie said the word taxes. And then, you know, Mayor Pete and Amy Klobuchar sort of attacked Elizabeth Warren. So, I just wanted to share a phenomenal tweet from actually someone I know. And it was a conversation about Mayor Pete. And Alex Thompson tweets out the following. This is the retweet. Pete kept up the healthcare attacks on Warren this morning. And he writes, this is on CNN. I have a lot of respect for Senator Warren, but last night she was more specific about the number of selfies she's taken than how this plan is going to be funded. All right. That was the sort of snarky comment by Mayor Pete. Now, do you know Wendell Potter? Do you know who Wendell Potter is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
Well, Wendell Potter is a former insurance guy. He's like an insurance whistleblower. He works for the Center for Public Integrity. I've been following Wendell Potter. In fact, I've had Wendell Potter on the air because he is so well informed about how the insurance industry basically rapes the economy. So Wendell Potter, this is phenomenal. This is what he retweeted. I can't tell if Pete Buttigieg is campaigning for president or my old job at Cigna. Mayor Pete, DM me if you want to know how insurance companies really operate. Ouch. Ouch.
Oh, good for him, and thank you for sharing that.
I know. I thought it would make you smile. But this is such an important, profound conversation that we actually have to have now, and everybody needs to roll up their sleeves and be honest about where the fight is, because right now we're sort of barking at each other at the edges, and yet this is really important for people to understand so they can make an informed decision.
And first of all, I think that's absolutely correct. And I also think that I totally agree on Buttigieg, who often just I find annoying. I know other people are really entranced by him. Mm-hmm. But all of these moments that he engineers for himself align him against the forces of change. At the same time, yeah, it's a valid point. And I really believe that Warren, whom I, you know, very much like, probably was told by her consultant. This is probably a moment where Elizabeth Warren listened to her pollster and her media consultant, and they said, whatever you do, don't be caught on television with a clip of saying you'll raise taxes, because they'll use it a million times against you.
That's exactly what I said. I told Elizabeth Warren's leader in New Hampshire that the other night at a house party.
Yeah, we're all furious with her about
it. She doesn't want a soundbite. Trump will play it over and over.
If Shakespeare were alive today, what he'd say is, first fire all the pollsters.
Yes, I agree.
And they really, the Democratic Party's codependent relationship with its, you know, it's addicted to its donors and codependent with its consultants.
What a great line.
And they just have to get out of both relationships. You know, they have to go cold turkey on the big donors, and they have to end the codependent relationships. You know, there are certain things you can use a pollster for and a writer for, but these people have really taken over the process. You've heard me say a million times, you know, policy precedes message.
Yes.
First you figure out what you believe and then how to tell people about it.
Yes.
And the Democrats, when the Republicans were building these great think tanks, right-wing think tanks in the 70s and 80s, the Democrats were marrying their celebrity pollsters. And it's been the wrong road for the Democratic Party. And even progressives get caught up in it. I know what it feels like to be running for governor, be involved in a presidential campaign, and your pollster comes in and tells you you have to do something. It shakes you up emotionally, but they have to learn. They have to learn to ignore it.
Well,
and so on healthcare, there's a lot of, you know, I don't believe that moving quickly to Medicare for all is the right thing to do. That I don't believe that. I do believe, however, that all of the public option proposals that are on the table are inadequate, and that they are often used, whether it's Klobuchar, Buttigieg, or Harris, simply to try to undercut the progressives. They use these positions as weapons. And I do really believe that, and I'm a little bit prejudiced, I introduced the first public option in the United States when I was controller of the state of Connecticut in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been fighting for it here ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And fought for it with Clinton when I was in the White House. Although I didn't win the fight within the White House.
No, obviously.
but there are a number of things to do here. I mean, if you just think about it, the goal is, first of all, universal health care. And the first point to make is that there is no reason to wait for universal health care. We can have that instantly. And any compromise that delays universal health care is a deal you don't have to make, either to satisfy the voters or to make it affordable, or for any other reason.
Now, explain that statement.
And because, first of all, if you set up a real public option, it involves a number of things. One, all public employees should be in it. All public employees today are privately insured. Our cities and towns and states and federal employees all have private insurance plans.
Mm-hmm.
They should all be in the public option.
Mm-hmm.
Which means it starts being at the moment it opens up, it's massive.
Yes, you're right.
Secondly, all self-employed and all small businesses and all nonprofits should be let in immediately, and they should be subsidized. Obama on the Obama exchanges, people below $56,000 a year received some form of subsidies, sliding scale subsidy.
Mm-hmm.
They did it if they got a public option, and they were subsidized for private for-profit companies, which was the basis on which the Republicans were able to bring a challenge all the way to the Supreme Court and almost invalidate the law.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans had a point we don't have any business subsidizing for-profit insurers,
right,
or requiring people, as the Republicans complained, to join a for-profit insurer or pay a penalty.
Right.
And that was actually the nub of their constitutional claim that almost prevailed, and it's a real claim. I don't want to be in the business of subsidizing the for-profit insurance industry. And so the subsidies should be for the public option.
Right.
At that point, the mandate works. The costs come down, I promise you. I've done this all my life. The costs come down considerably. The subsidies are substantial. And people at that point can be paying. You can call it a fine. You can call it a tax. There was a great deal of disputation over nomenclature during all this. But the bottom line is everybody's got to pay. Everybody's got to be in that system. Now, what does that leave out? You put all the public employees and the nonprofits and the self-employed and the small businesses into what would then be the largest single-payer health care system in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got large employers left. And their insurance companies are no longer getting government-subsidized people from the individual market. They've got these large employers. One, I don't care. I don't care if that part of the country still has, I don't care deeply about that or feel the need to make that instant change.
Right.
I am aware that if I move everybody out of the for-profit insurers provided by insurance provided by employers, some employers still pay more than 80% of the cost. Yeah. Some employers, many, you know, with millions
UAW,
of customers.
The car industry, for example.
Yeah, all those people. All those people would then have to have it absorbed in their taxes. They would the people who resist this are people who are still getting a decent insurance deal. For whom when Warren says the costs won't go up, she means the average cost. She doesn't mean the cost for each family. It's directly analogous to Obama's promise that if you like your doctor, you can keep him.
Right.
Obama should have been more honest in that moment, but his pollsters told him he had to say that.
Right.
What he should have said is that under the present system, tens of millions of you lose your doctor every year.
Yes.
Far fewer
will
lose your doctor under the
more
new system.
Accurate, absolutely.
That would have been completely true.
Absolutely.
But under the system, if we move instantly to Medicare for All, there's a large group of people who instantly pay more.
Mm-hmm.
And they're dubious.
Mm-hmm.
And the second reason they're dubious is that we haven't built the system yet.
Right.
And they watched how we handled everything from the Obamacare exchange to the the Obamacare web portal.
Right.
To the administration, the Veterans Administration, and everything else the government does. And government takes a bad rap, and Democrats have been acceding to it for too long and should be defending it more robustly than we do. But it's not too much for the taxpayer to say, I'd like to see this system up and running before you force me to join it.
Right. Well, that's the Canadian model. The Canadian model was they experimented. And then after they worked out the kinks and they saw what was successful and what failed and what didn't, then they embraced it as a nation. They didn't turn a switch on. So tell me one thing.
Now, let me just make one last point. And this is the last one. And I'll try to do it in three sentences.
No.
Okay. The bottom line, however, is that we have three big problems. The two biggest problems are for-profit insurers who charge us more than twice as much for overhead. A third of every dollar spent goes to overhead in America.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is the for-profit insurance industry.
Mm-hmm.
The cost it imposes on the rest of the system, mm-hmm, and the unearned profits it extracts.
Mm-hmm.
And the second problem we have is the high cost of pharmaceuticals, and the third cost is corruption. We have more corruption than Asia or Europe by quite a bit in our medical system. And so what we need to do is create a situation in which we begin to move for whoever is still getting private insurance through an employer, we have to begin to move to a system in which there are nonprofits as opposed to for-profits, and taking away these subsidies and regulating more closely. But above all, by having a real public option like the one I've described, people will be beating down the doors to get into
it. I agree.
The last force you need to get all the way there is just gravity. It will happen naturally. So we can get, so we have, our two big objectives are to insure everyone and bring down costs. Not just subsidize people so they can afford the exorbitant costs, but to bring down the costs. We can do those two things. We don't have to wait 4 years. It doesn't have to take as long as even Bernie's bill says. But as long as you don't take the last piece of the employer-provided health care first.
Okay, so let me just say something. I think Elizabeth knows that, because whenever she talks to folks like from the UAW, which has the Cadillac of plans where the employer pays over 80% of the cost of health care, and I think they only pay about 3 or 5%, they're, of course, neurotic. And Elizabeth is very interesting, because she doesn't say, I'll take it away from you. She says, I'll work with you. Isn't that
right.
Interesting? So she kind of, she is, I think she is mirroring what you say. Now, let me ask
one more. First of all, she's so smart. She must know most of what I just said.
Exactly right. Exactly. Now, let me just ask about the other smart person that I've been sort of trashing, Mayor Pete. He talks about Medicare for all who want it. Is what he's suggesting also a variation on the Bill Curry response to how you fix health care? Or is there something I'm missing about what he wants? Absolutely not.
Rich people and poor people are equally prohibited from sleeping under a bridge. That's an Anatole France quote.
Your choice means if
you can't afford it, you don't really have a choice. If you can't afford private insurance, you don't have a choice.
Right. All right, keep going. Bill?
But he'll be providing, he'll be providing subsidies.
Yes, he will.
It's a somewhat more complicated question. And the problem, I just want to say, without going into everybody's health care plan,
I know.
There are two problems. One of which is that it does leave more people out.
Yes.
He hasn't described a universal health care system.
Right.
That's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't have. I talked about everybody coming in and restoring the Obama mandate, so long as you're not subsidizing for-profit insurers, creating a larger public option,
right.
A pool so that you're driving costs down even more. He doesn't have any of that.
Okay, good.
Okay?
Yeah.
And secondly, the bigger problem is in their rhetoric. All of them are using it to try to discredit the goal. Every one of them should say, if they want to be sincere, they should begin by saying, I get that for-profit insurance is a scam.
Exactly.
I understand that we need to move from this model. Don't get me wrong. I'm not just appeasing my big donors, Mayor Pete, Kamala, who drew up her proposal with healthcare lobbyists. You know, I'm not just scamming you.
Yeah.
We're going to get rid of this.
But let's also remember, we talked about this morning, and that is there are other models around the world. There's not only one sort of way to get to God on the whole way of creating some kind of universal, affordable health care. And that is that when you look at the German model or the Swiss model, they do have private insurance, but it's private nonprofit. It's highly regulated.
The Swiss model, which I'm not espousing, is the American model up until the 1970s. America had nonprofit insurance. The Blues were all nonprofits until 30 years ago.
Right.
And the healthcare system began to fall apart when two things happened. Our close regulation of healthcare on a state-by-state basis was disemboweled.
Yes.
And made toothless.
Yes.
So we had a hospitals and healthcare commission in Connecticut that really kept track of duplicative services and growing bureaucracies and really kept them reined in. And secondly, it was a nonprofit model and insurance, and the costs were much lower. When we deregulated the industry and put the insurance on a for-profit basis, costs went through the roof. When people talk about the Swiss system, you could just say, oh, yeah, that's America in 1955, when healthcare really wasn't a crisis.
Right.
In the same way, for most working people, it wasn't.
Well, and I think there's also a requirement that you have to purchase something. I mean, it's like you can join. There's the Swiss. You can join the Swiss model for offering insurance. You can join the private nonprofit, but you have to figure out which one you want. But you have to pick one.
People say progressives sort of clumsily say every other country has a single payer. Okay,
no,
nothing could be further the truth.
Only four
or five other countries have
Thank
single
you.
Payer.
Thank you.
But every country has compulsory participation.
Yep.
And no other country has for-profit insurance.
Yes.
They have niche markets for the wealthy, for-profit.
So why don't we have – no one knows this, Bill. I know it. You know it. I mean, it turns out that, for example, in Switzerland, I think 80% of the Swiss participate in the Swiss plan, not the private, nonprofit, highly regulated plan. 80% of them have bought into the Swiss plan. So even when they were given a choice, the vast majority of Swiss went, the government does a pretty good job.
When we give them – If we build the public options I've just described,
right,
and people are looking at how much better the benefits are and how much lower the premiums are,
right,
when employers are looking at how much better the benefits are and how much lower the premiums are, most of American industry will want to get out from under the millstone, they carry around their necks.
Right.
So why don't they use their economic power now to do that?
Yeah.
Why don't the big companies use their economic power to say, we're not going to go with you,
Cigna? Why isn't GM and Ford and Toyota doing exactly what you're saying? They don't want to. I mean, the average cost is $20,000 a year for a family. That's what they're paying. And if they're paying three-quarters of it, a half of it, who cares?
Why are the businesses okay with that?
The father of the United Auto Workers, Walter Ruth, who wrote a letter to the president of General Motors way back then, when GM was offering health care as a benefit to its workers. And Reuther said, I don't want it.
Wow.
Because you can't afford it. If you take it on, it will someday bankrupt all of us.
Oh my
Come
God.
With me to the government, and let's get the government to do this.
Oh, my God. Print
and
that
they,
letter.
Yeah, and they say it's a wonderful and heartbreaking read.
Yeah.
And of course that's the answer. And many, many people in that situation who are running, lots of small businesses are already for it. But when you get to the very top, they all swim in the same waters, and all their interlocking directorates, and all the sense that they have a other common interests, and also, by the way, their sheer their own ideology. Once you've said to yourself 1,000 times over that the private sector always is more efficient than the public sector, you can't see a thing like this clearly.
Exactly.
They build themselves as empiricists who look at the facts first, but they never are.
So, it's what is so interesting to me is if you look at I don't know what happened with the UAW strike. I know they're coming to some kind of a possible settlement. I haven't seen what the terms are yet. They haven't voted on it yet, I don't think. But what is so interesting is if you understand what was the sort of underpinnings of the strike, first of all, it was about benefits, but not benefits for full-time workers, permanent workers. It was about benefits for temporary workers, of which now almost one out of every four or one out of every five workers at those UAW facilities for GM are temporary. They can never become permanent. They get paid almost less, about a half of what a permanent worker is. Their benefits suck compared to what a permanent worker is. And they realize that every time a permanent worker retires or dies, they're not being replaced by a permanent worker. They're being replaced by a temporary worker. And so as we talk about the Cadillac plans that these UAW guys have negotiated, not for the growing segment of unionized workers, which are temporary workers. And it's all about health care. And what did they threaten to do when they went on strike? They threatened to take away their health insurance, so these people that were getting the $250 a week strike fund would suddenly have to pay for COBRA, which they couldn't afford. It was about health care that they used as their hammer against the unions. Get away from health care. Have a conversation about your paycheck, but not about your health.
Almost every major human resources decision that a big company has made in America in my lifetime has been destructive of the middle class.
Yes, please hear
whether
this.
It's sending their workers abroad and their work abroad, or take their stance in all of these negotiations, it's just so they want to just have the work. Their answer is keep government out of it, but make the workers pay more.
Exactly.
And so that's why nobody has real disposable income in America anymore.
Exactly.
It's the death of disposable income. If people want to spend on something extra, they have to borrow from a credit card company.
And on that note, I need to let you go, Bill Curry. I wish this conversation was being heard on CNN. I wish this conversation was on MSNBC. I know everyone watches Rachel Maddow. Rachel Maddow has never had this discussion ever. ever, ever. Thank you so much.
It's not what she does for a living.
I know. Goodbye. I'll talk to you later. Thank you. Ciao. Bye-bye.
But things are going to get better. To all your listeners, things are going to get better.
Yes, sir. Yes, I promise.
Trump's on his way to the slammer, and they're doing so bad on the Republican side that almost no amount of Democratic malpractice can blow it.
I love you. All right, almost. Goodbye. I love you, Bill Curry. Take care. All right, and we're going to end with the spiritual.
Spiritual by John Coltrane,
for Elijah,
which is in memory of Elijah Cummings.
Here we go.